Welcome to a special edition of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. In this episode, we revisit a live Twitter space discussion featuring Dr. Ritu Salani and Dr. Dana Chase, both from UCLA Health. They discussed findings presented at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology 2023 annual meeting on women's cancer and how they may apply to clinical practice. Clinical trials of interest in this discussion included the NRG-GY-018 trial, the Phase 3 RUBY trial, and the Phase 3 NOVA study.
So if you want to kick it off by starting to discuss the NRG-GY-018 trial that was presented at the conference.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'll get started. Hi, Dana. It's nice to be here with you and discuss some of this game-changing science that was presented.
I agree. Nice to be here to talk about it and recap.
So one of the things I thought was most exciting was the kind of impending practice-changing trials that resulted, which I know you were part of one of them, which is RUBY, but also GY018, which was presented, which looked at the addition, both of these studies look at the addition of checkpoint inhibitors to chemotherapy in the setting of advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer. And I think a lot of us were very excited about these trials and really looking forward to this data where we had gotten press releases but not seen the actual results. And so GY18 was done predominantly in the United States, where they looked at patients with advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer. And the patients who had recurrent could have received systemic chemotherapy beforehand, but they had to have at least a year in between. And they randomized patients to checkpoint inhibitor with pembrolizumab, to chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel versus placebo. And there was maintenance strategy for up to 2 years in those patients with either pembrolizumab or placebo. And patients were, the mismatch repair status was also evaluated. And so a majority of patients, as expected, were mismatch repair proficient, but they broke this down into two groups of mismatch repair deficient and proficient. And the press release that had come out in February had kind of indicated that they had met both of their endpoints, which is really exciting. And what we finally saw is that the progression-free survival, which was the primary endpoint for both of these groups, had been reached with kind of a more pronounced result in the mismatch repair deficient group, but still a notable response in the mismatch repair proficient group. And I was really pleased to see this. I think we didn't know where the mismatch repair proficient group was going to fall out, but it was a pretty notable difference between the two groups with a clear benefit with the addition of pembrolizumab. I'd love to hear what your take is on that.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely thought it was exciting to see that the, you know, the traditional biomarker for pembrolizumab in endometrial cancer is being deficient in mismatch repair, at least to use pembro as a single agent for treatment. But it was really interesting, I think, to see in combination with chemotherapy followed by maintenance that the proficient group, which is technically the biomarker negative group, that they also seem to benefit, although not to the same extent. Definitely the hazard ratio of 0.54, I think, was noteworthy in a group that you would think was biomarker negative. And I am anxious to see, you know, what we are allowed to use in the proficient group. And hopefully those women will also be eligible to get pembro for first line or metastatic recurrent. I think there must be something else, some other biomarker in those women that's driving the response. It'd also be interesting to see what that kind of additional indication is in the proficient group. And I also just, you know, want to comment that it seems also to be pretty well tolerated. I will say that the presence of a grade 3 to 5 toxicity in both groups was fairly low, but also just to remember the toxicities of colitis and thyroid issues in these patients is important to also not forget. But yeah, I agree that that definitely it was great to see a response in the biomarker negative group.
Yeah, I think like just to capitalize on what you said, I think one really interesting thing is, you know, the progression-free survival, median progression-free survival hadn't been reached in the mismatch repair deficient group. And it kind of seemed to, the curves kind of seemed to flatten out even after that 2-year mark. So maybe you have that sustained benefit. And same thing in the mismatch repair proficient group where you kind of curves flatten out, but the median progression-free survival had been reached in that group. I think there are a couple of things that I just want to point out that I just kind of hearing the presentation, reading the manuscript, it is limited follow-up, right? So the median follow-up was less than a year in these patients. And so, you know, I think getting more information and understanding what the implications of maybe second-line therapies, where we commonly use pembrolizumab in addition with lenvatinib in this population, how that might be influenced. I do think they reported the rates of immunotherapy that were given afterwards, and I think it was about 30%, but I may have to double check that number. So I think that, you know, if we can improve outcomes in the frontline setting, that's probably the best. And I agree, we're pretty comfortable using checkpoint inhibitors with chemotherapy now. So I'm glad to see that no new safety signals were seen. I'm wondering if we're going to see a little bit of the PARP story where maybe we'll get approvals and, you know, more data will inform if that stays or not, or maybe we'll get the approval and it will just stick. I'm
Yeah.
curious to see how the FDA and other governing regulatory bodies handle this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think these days it seems like they want to see overall survival. And I guess we just don't have that yet. And in our experience with other GYN cancers, sometimes the overall survival outcome is can be, not always, but can be disappointing, especially in the, you know, biomarker negative group or in the patients that have some biomarker, but it's maybe not as strong as being deficient in MMR. But yeah, time will tell. I think we can maybe also talk about the RUBY trial. So I think you know, it's tough to compare these two trials and just reading and rereading the presentations and the manuscripts, it's just kind of impossible to put them side by side and make the same conclusions. But definitely also in the RUBY trial, we're able to see some signals in the pMMR and then definitely also in the de deficient in MMR group, which is very, very significant or noteworthy like it was in GY018. But I know you've Dr. Salani told me some of your thoughts about the RUBY trial, which I thought were really interesting. So I'll let you talk about that.
Oh, you might have to remind me, but I think, you know, one, congratulations to you being a co-author on this, I think very, you know, important paper that is going to change standard of care. I think some of the really interesting things about RUBY is, you know, just first of all, they included carcinosarcomas, which I was thrilled about, right? I think we have good phase three data that shows that these really do act like epithelial cancers, and we really should exclude them from these trials. So I was really happy to see that carcinosarcomas were included in this. And then once again, they also allowed prior systemic therapy, but they had a 6-month disease-free interval. So a little bit of a higher risk group, if you will. So I think that that was kind of like two little points that I always like to note. And then, you know, their primary outcome being overall survival, I think was really impactful. So it was a PFS and overall survival, but they kind of had more data or more results, I guess, that were presented. And, you know, same, I think the survival curves, like you said, we can't compare them because they are different populations. You know, this was predominantly ex-US, but just really, really powerful data with a hazard ratio of 0.28 in the mismatch repair deficient group in progression-free survival and 0.64 in the overall population. When you look at the overall survival, we still see a kind of a favoring of the overall population with the dostarlimab added to the chemotherapy with a hazard ratio of 0.64. And same thing, more pronounced in that deficient group with a hazard ratio of 0.30. We did seem to lose that trend a little bit with the proficient group, where it was 0.73, but it crossed one. But there still is a kind of notable difference. At 2 years, 67.7% were still alive and 55.1% in the placebo group. So maybe not statistically significant, but still clinically significant. And we know that some of those patients would have received immunotherapy in the second line setting. So it might have kind of washed or neutralized some of those patients who responded. I think this data is really impressive, and I'm really excited that checkpoint inhibitors clearly mismatch repair deficient group benefits there. I don't think there's any question that this should be the standard of care. Was there anything else that you thought was interesting about the two groups?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to also emphasize that the deficient group, is definitely the minority of patients. So, yes, this is really exciting for those that are deficient in MMR, and that's, maybe somewhere between 20 and 30% of our patients with advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer. But still, the good majority of patients are proficient in MMR, and I think really teasing out some of the characteristics of that group in terms of trying to figure out who the ones in that group are that are going to have response to this type of Ruby or GY018 regimen will be interesting to know in the future. And then, as we know from our other GYN cancers, the overall survival endpoint I think is helpful for the FDA or the other agencies that make decisions about what patients can receive. But overall survival is obviously very clouded by down the line regimens that patients receive. So anyway, so it should be interesting to see what we can do for the proficient in MMR group and which one of these drugs, pembro or dostarlimab, which one will be available for the proficient in MMR patients, if any.
Yeah,
So we'll see.
I think that's a big question, but I think that the clear takeaways are that in the deficient group, we have a clear winner. The toxicities, I think, are very manageable, and I would say a lot of us who treat cervical cancer have been using chemotherapy with a checkpoint inhibitor for some time now, so I think that this will be a very easy transition. I think a lot of in the United States, probably pembrolizumab is more commonly used than dostarlimab, but I definitely think it plays a role, and I'm wondering if how detailed the label will be in regards to carcinosarcoma, the overall survival versus the progression-free survival. So I think there's some nuances that will still be detailed out. I would be an advocate for using this in the proficient group too, but I'll be curious to see what kind of other experts and, like you said, the regulatory bodies have to say about that.
Yeah, and I think your point about carcinosarcoma being kind of an epithelial origin is a really good one to make. And I wish I could have been involved in the planning of GY018 when they decided to exclude those patients, because they're now thought to be really epithelial in origin. So interesting that they would have made that a group excluded, but.
Yeah, and it may have been when the protocol was initially written, because I don't know if we have the results from the carcinosarcoma trial where it really showed that carboplatin and paclitaxel was a standard. And I did, but
True,
I, you know, I
yeah.
was at the NRG meeting just recently, and carcinosarcoma was exclusionary in one of the trials. And somebody actually, I can't recall who, but somebody got up and said, "Hey, let's take this out." It might have actually been Dr. Eskander, who was the PI on GY018, but I think it's a really important thing. We need to advocate for those patients because we are seeing those. I think the one thing that I also just want to point out is it does kind of the space gets a little bit complicated because carcinosarcomas and serous carcinomas, which are also included, also have HER2 amplifications, and how we manage whether immunotherapy is really right for these patients, or trastuzumab, or some variation of trastuzumab, whether it's an ADC or not, I think will be really interesting. We're a little bit kind of crowding it's a very small space, and we're kind of crowding it with kind of these interesting novel therapies or approaches. And I think understanding how to sequence these will be really important in the future.
Yes, I agree. I mean, that's an interesting point. I wonder within the carcinosarcoma group, in the pMMR group, how many of those patients were HER2 also would be interesting to look at that.
Well, I see we have some listeners on here, and I know one is actually an
Yeah.
expert in testing endometrial cancer molecular analyses. So I'd be curious to see if he has thoughts on that, maybe when we have question discussion, but I won't call him out. So, you know, Dr. Chase, one thing I was thinking about is that, you know, we have gotten a lot of approvals, and there's a lot of accelerated approvals, which I hear are now going to be disappearing. So they're no longer going to be doing accelerated approvals. But I think this brings us to the PARP story. And, you know, we were really
Yeah.
excited with PARPs in the recurrent setting, got very comfortable with that, and then, you know, kind of changed the managed landscape with PARPs being moved to the front line. And we might actually see that same phenomenon with checkpoint inhibitors and endometrial cancer. But one thing that ended up happening is that the FDA kind of asked the companies to withdraw their label for the recurrent setting of PARP inhibitors, particularly in the non-BRCA mutated carriers. And I'm curious to see kind of what your thoughts were on the NOVA study that was presented by Dr. Matulonis at the recent SGO meeting.
Yeah, I mean, this is a story of strong biomarker, just like PMMR, strong biomarker, medium biomarker, and then no biomarker. And I was really, and I still am so surprised to see that the, yes, of course, the strong biomarker, the BRCA mutated patients still probably benefit from PARP inhibitor maintenance in a recurrent setting. But the medium biomarker patients, the HRD patients and the HRP patients, so the negative biomarker and then the HRD patients, gosh, they just don't seem to benefit in terms of survival, which is confusing. I mean, you would like to think that getting a PARP inhibitor in maintenance earlier on in the recurrent setting maybe would have more of an impact on survival, but in those two patient populations, it just looks like it doesn't. And is it potentially dangerous? You know, do those patients maybe have worse survival and or maybe now a little bit of a higher risk of MDS, AML incidence? So anyway, I think it's a no-brainer that you can use PARP inhibitor maintenance in a BRCA-mutated patient population in the recurrent platinum-sensitive setting, but I think many of us at this point sort of hesitate and can't use niraparib for the HRD or the HRP patients, at least for maintenance in the recurrent setting. So if you're going to use that drug, you probably have to really get it in first line for the patients that aren't BRCA mutated.
Yeah, I think that's probably the takeaway. I do struggle a little bit with the way kind of this request for withdrawal came about. You know, when we look at subgroups, it's hard to kind of, you know, put a lot of stake in that without really understanding that you're breaking it down. This was not a planned analysis, and they, you know, really didn't have a great sense of, you know, I don't think any of us knew that this was coming down. And when, you know, I'm looking at Dr. Matulonis'
yeah.
slides, and the HRD population actually had a hazard ratio of 1.29, and the HRP population
yeah.
had a hazard ratio of 0.93. Now, this makes no sense to me. That
no sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you had to put it in context, and the survival, median overall survival was still, you know, higher in the HRD population. So, yeah, I think you have to use it up front if you're going to use it in this population. I just can't make sense of this data. So I thought it was really surprising. I was happy to see in the final analysis that there were no new safety signals, no concerns, that the, you know, rates of MDS were relatively this what we would expect in this population.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a little bit higher in the patients who were BRCA mutation, because they probably receive a lot more therapies across the board. But really kind of, you know, I still have a little bit of an asterisk by the state in my mind, because I understand it. I recognize what they've mandated, but I still struggle a little bit with how they interpreted this data after the fact.
Yeah, I agree. And I guess if you're a patient that's considering treatment in this setting, like second line, platinum sensitive, you finished your chemotherapy, you know, I'm guessing that as the patient, you want the longest treatment-free interval as possible. I mean, you might consider that you might not survive past 3 or 4 years, but that after that second line chemo, you're still interested in seeing maybe if you can get over a year of chemo free or treatment free time. And definitely, you know, even if you're HRD, you could expect to have an extended treatment free time. However, like you said, you're unfortunately your survival doesn't seem to be impacted by that. But these are tough conversations to have with the patient. And now that we cannot use this drug in this setting, in that group, it's challenging.
Yeah, but you hit on something that I think resonates with me, and it's a secondary endpoint in the study, but the time to first subsequent treatment was actually longer in the mm-hmm. patients who received niraparib versus placebo in the non-BRCA germline mutated group, as was PFS2, as was time to second subsequent treatment. And, you know, I think this can be meaningful. Yeah. You know, we look at, and I Dr. Chase is a world-renowned expert in quality of life. And I think one of the things we think about is when we do quality of life measures, we do it on trial. But what really probably matters is actually when the patient stops, right? When their quality of life starts becoming worse because they stop this therapy and their disease starts progressing, or, you know, they start a new regimen, aka chemotherapy, where their side effects or quality of life might be even more impacted. So, you know, I hate to just dismiss, I recognize it, I accept it. I think we need better strategies regardless. So I'm excited about new things that are upcoming, like the VIGIL trial, which is in the front line for the HRP population. And I think we need to think of new novel therapies like UpNext trial, which is looking at upifitamab, rilsedotin in this population. So I think there are other things that are, you know, mirvetuximab in this population. So I think there are other things that are on the horizon. So I think that's the solace, our consolation prize, is that we have new therapies that we can explore and still try to make a better impact for these patients.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I want to also emphasize the point you made is that patients' quality of life worsens when they have a recurrence. And I wish that regulatory agencies like FDA would recognize that is an important important point, that patients' quality of life worsens when they have a recurrence, and the longer time they have without a recurrence, better in terms of quality of life. And we have publications to support that.
Yeah, I think the big X factor is the cost, right? And so that's the thing we need to rectify. But I think you're exactly right. So I actually heard a trial, and I know you and I briefly spoke about it, that I thought was really provocative, and that was the NOW trial. It's a phase 1 trial looking at neoadjuvant olaparib in patients with a germline BRCA mutation. They could have a RAD51 mutation and a PALB2 mutation, but they looked at this giving olaparib for 2 cycles in the neoadjuvant setting, and then taking the patients for interval debulking surgery, followed by adjuvant therapy. And there was kind of a hodgepodge of adjuvant therapy regimens that were used. But, you know, it was a small study. I think it was 15 patients. But I would love to hear your take on it, because I have so many thoughts about this.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really interesting. I think I would love to see it happen in more patients. I had a couple questions for Dr. Weston, but one of them was, I was curious what this, so most of the patients either, no patients were left suboptimal, so with residual disease, but I was curious how aggressive the surgeries were. And so my question is, if you get olaparib in the neoadjuvant setting, is your interval debulking a more difficult surgery for you? And so you really would have to compare olaparib versus traditional chemotherapy in a neoadjuvant approach, and what the surgeries look like. Because if you could tell me that my patient, if she got chemo first and neoadjuvant, she would have less chance of an ICU stay, less blood transfusions, less bowel resections, less risk of infection, quicker time to resumption of chemotherapy. If you tell me that neoadjuvant chemo is more likely to lead to less morbidity than neoadjuvant olaparib, that might change my mind. So not knowing what the surgeries were and the post-operative courses were, a little hard for me to make an assumption about olaparib and the neoadjuvant approach. But I think the fact that they were able to get patients to have a pretty significant response with olaparib given neoadjuvant, at least by imaging in CA125. I think that was really, really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, kudos to Dr. Weston and her group because I think this is a really provocative and really kind of steps outside the box. You know, there, I agree. I think the not knowing the details of this surgery is a little, you know, I think it leaves a little gap in information. And it's important to note that the responsive therapy, they had about 54% of patients with a partial response. And so, you know, a fair number of patients, almost half of the patients had either stable disease, and I think one patient had progressive disease. And I'm not sure that, you know, and I don't know this data off the top of my head, so it's probably out there and I just need to do a deeper dive. But it seems a little bit lower than with what we would expect to see with chemotherapy. You
Yeah.
know, I think the degree of response at least. And we do have chemotherapy response scores, and I think looking at that comparatively, and I love your concept of, you know, a randomized trial looking at olaparib neoadjuvant versus chemotherapy neoadjuvant, and then really looking at kind of what that means for these patients. Honestly, in my
Yeah,
mind,
at least
oh, go
this,
ahead.
yeah. Oh, at least this gives you some preliminary data to say to a patient, hey, there's some potential here. Would you want to go on this trial, in a BRCA mutated patient, for example? Gives me a little bit more confidence in enrolling a patient on this type of a trial, but still, I think I need more information.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, you know, they did a really nice job of having kind of like a streamlined genetic testing process so that patients could get tested kind of immediately and have that turnaround time in a short period of time to know if they could go on the study or not. So I think, you know, something we should all strive for is like a streamlined process, but we know that in reality, that's not always possible. But, you know, I would love to hear your thoughts. So I
Yeah.
thought about this trial a lot. And in my mind, I would favor doing chemotherapy up front, then doing interval debulking and then randomizing patients to olaparib versus, you know, more chemotherapy. Because I think one thing that I struggle with
Yeah.
is these patients got olaparib up front. I mean, nobody had a complete response. And you would expect that in a, you know, maybe a BRCA population for some of those patients to maybe have it with chemotherapy. So I do think the response may be better with chemotherapy, totally speculative. But then also, gosh, I'd hate to give a patient olaparib, do surgery, and then give her chemotherapy, and now she's losing her hair, and now she's having all these sequelae. That maybe if you could get out of the way first, do surgery, and then they're, you know, on the I shouldn't say
Yeah.
maintenance, but on the treatment slash maintenance strategy, instead of doing olaparib, surgery, chemo, and then olaparib, as they did in this trial for a majority of the patients. So
Yeah,
I.
that's a great idea.
Yeah, so I would have probably designed it differently, but I think it's still really provocative, and I think it shows that, man, this is not just a maintenance strategy. This really is a treatment strategy, which takes us back to what we just talked about with the niraparib. You know, is that these drugs actually do have a little bit more of a, you know, a lot of those patients had a partial response. So in the NOVA trial and the, you know, SOLO2 trial and the ARIEL trials, so there is some activity, you know. Treatment activity in with these PARP inhibitors, and this study really just highlights how active these agents can be.
Yeah. I mean, I will just emphasize your point that sometimes when you give chemotherapy preoperatively and you do interval surgery and there's no disease left over, you wonder, gosh, why do I have to put this patient back on chemotherapy? All the disease is gone. And that would be an ideal patient to just go right to olaparib with. And that would be a great study to do down the road. Maybe that's their next step.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I mean, I commend them. I think that, you know, the patients who went on this were very, you know, I think just very novel and they're,
Brave.
yeah, very brave, very novel and very, you know, this is, I think, really exciting. And I think it really does kind of set the stage that we need to be more creative in thinking about how we approach these patients and trials. So I'm really looking forward to more data from this trial. And I hope they do kind of standardize their post-surgery treatment because it was a little bit up to the it was up
Yeah.
to the provider and there was a lot of variety. So I hope that that's standardized. So we
Right.
really do have a good idea of how to manage these patients. But you know, I think all of the studies that we've talked about today are just really kind of game changers or really informative. And I think that these are, you know, I'm so excited because I remember there was a period of time where we didn't have any new drugs. We were just kind of repurposing drugs. We're looking at different strategies. And now we're talking about these really novel treatments that are changing our practice.
Yep. and potentially limiting, traditional chemotherapy, which in my quality of life plug here, if you can limit, exposure to cytotoxic traditional standard chemotherapy and do alternative approaches like PARP inhibition or immunotherapy, I think ultimately better for the patients.
Yeah, I totally agree. Were there any other trials that you thought that kind of resonated with you or stuck out to you that you want to just mention?
I would just say that the 258, it was hard to see exactly what was new in that presentation, but I just it's also because many of us have sort of reintroduced radiation into our treatment of endometrial cancer frontline, but that was a GOG trial that looked at chemo radiation with chemotherapy versus just traditional chemotherapy alone in an advanced stage 3 or 4 endometrial cancer patient. And really this updated data definitely continued to demonstrate that chemotherapy is the standard of care. And although many of us want to introduce radiation into the mix there somehow, it doesn't seem to affect outcomes in any major way. So I thought that was interesting to talk about again. And then there was another Dr. Zamarin presented a study looking at dostarlimab, or I think actually was it durvalumab? No, I'm blanking. But IO introduced before chemoradiation for locally advanced cervical cancer versus immunotherapy with
Yeah,
chemoradiation
it was
for locally
atezolizumab.
advanced cervical cancer. I thought that was an interesting atezolizumab. Sorry about that.
Yeah,
I thought that was an interesting presentation.
no, I agree. I think those were two kind of nice. I think one kind of a confirmatory study, final analysis. I always think it's great to get those updates, and kind of provocative insights into sequencing of treatments. I thought the other one that I just want to kind of give a little shout out to was vulvar cancer study looking at gemcitabine and cisplatin. It was a phase 3 trial. It was a phase 3 trial by Dr. Horowitz, where they looked at the combination patients getting neoadjuvant chemo radiation and just had really nice results that kind of capitalized on it. It wasn't randomized, so I think we still have to learn a little bit about it, but they were able to manage the toxicities, and I think that's a patient group that we really struggle with when they have advanced disease on how to control their disease and optimize their treatment. So I commend the authors for looking and the NRG for looking at that kind of subset of groups and getting that trial done.
Yep, I agree. Would be nice to have something new to give those patients for sure.
I know. We need something. There are last year at SGO there was a study of pembrolizumab in that population, not in that population, but recurrent disease, and maybe there is a role for IO in a subset of vulvar cancer. So I think we need to keep pushing the boundaries and thinking about these because that's really where we're going to change the standard of care for these patients.
Agreed.
So I don't know if we have any questions coming in from our listeners, and we thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, so if anybody has any questions, you can request to speak, or you can leave a comment on our Twitter page. So while we wait, I guess, for a minute or so, if any come in, I know it was previously mentioned that you are considering kind of your standard of practice with these trials that were presented. Is there any one that really stood out to you that you're going to initiate going forward?
I mean, the checkpoint inhibitors in the mismatch repair deficient is a no-brainer for me.
Yeah, me too. Me
I
too.
think that's that if anybody left that presentation thinking that they're not going to do that, that would be, I mean, that power data was powerful. Not sure that there was anything else that I would take away. I mean, there's a lot of things I was excited about that I look forward to getting more information, but that was probably the biggest game changer.
Right, yeah, I agree. Lots of potential ideas to study come out of SGO or ideas to look at your own institution, but other than those two presentations, nothing that I would necessarily start doing right away.
There was another interesting presentation. There was a resident or a fellow who presented it, and they show that patients who go on clinical trials actually have better outcomes than those who receive standard of care, particularly the platinum-resistant group. And I think that's just something to highlight when we're offering patients clinical trials, is that we actually are providing really great care. You know, I think patients always have that concern about, and you know, I don't mean to dismiss their concern, but just, you know, concerns about being a guinea pig or being experimental, but it really is changing the standard of care. And these studies are rooted in good science, preclinical and even some early clinical data. And so I think that study just kind of highlighted that, you know, patients on clinical trials really do have better outcomes. Maybe it's a testament to newer drugs and monitoring and, you know, maybe patient selection of who goes on trials and who doesn't. But I think it's definitely something worth highlighting.
Yeah, that's, I forgot about that presentation. That was pretty outstanding that they were able to show that, and definitely hopefully that makes its way into some of the patient literature or patient support groups, because I thought that was really noteworthy.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that they kind of touched upon, and there was a, it was kind of a theme throughout the meeting, is, you know, we need to make sure that all of our patients are being getting good access to clinical trials, as we do have disparities. And so I think rectifying some of those by, you know, counseling and education of our patients, their families, their other healthcare providers is going to be really critical, and making sure we really understand that how these drugs work in different groups, different, you know, biologies of disease and different populations where we have, you know, different physiologic metabolism of drugs. So it may have a different impact. So I think that was really exciting. And we always talk about this because we see studies that come out of, you know, Asia, where we see these response rates that are by far better than we've ever seen in the United States. And I think there's a different maybe biology or physiology of the disease or the drugs.
So I have not seen any other questions come through, but if you just wanted to kind of round this off, if there's anything else that you both wanted to discuss from the meeting or in gynecologic care overall.
You know, go ahead, Dana.
Oh, I think we covered some high impact areas. You know, endometrial cancer is on the rise. One of the few cancers that's on the rise, and definitely, unfortunately, it affects different populations in different ways. And there's for sure health disparities and outcome disparities in the endometrial cancer realm. So moving forward, I think we need to pay a lot of attention to both endometrial cancer as a group of patients in terms of prevention, early diagnosis, and treatment, and then also have to pay attention to diversity in race, socioeconomic status, educational status in that patient population to make sure that all patients are given a fair chance.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So that was sort of my take home.
I think the other thing that I was kind of, you know, I get so excited about these practice changing presentations, but it disrupts our second line therapy, our treatments down the road. And so I think we need to be strategic about if checkpoint inhibitors are being used first line, what does that mean for second line? Are we back to chemotherapy? You know, are there other things that are on the horizon? And how do we, you know, get these trials to our patients in a more timely fashion? So disruption is good. You know, I'm not complaining about it, but it leaves a gap because we know we still are not curing a majority of these patients. And so we still need to do, you know, find those therapies for that second line and how to sequence these therapies, and checkpoint inhibitors after checkpoint inhibitors or novel combinations with checkpoint inhibitors are going to be really, I think, the mainstay for particularly the mismatch repair deficient group, but, you know, also in the proficient group where we were using lenvatinib and pembrolizumab as standard, as typically standard for recurrence. So I think this will be an exciting era where we're going to be, you know, I think our feet are being held to the fire that we need to keep, we can't become complacent. We need to keep going.
All right, great.
I completely agree. And clinical trials are the way.
Well, thank you both so much for joining. This was a really great way to recap the SGO meeting. To continue to receive updates on latest coverage in cancer care, be sure to visit our website, cancernetwork.com, and follow us on our social media. I hope you all have a great rest of your day.
Thanks so much.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com /resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of CancerNetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at CancerNetwork.com and find us at Twitter @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @Cancer-Network.